President Biden has signed more than 30 executive actions during his first week in office aimed at preserving the DACA program, rejoining the Paris Climate Accord, and more. Executive orders and other actions were also used by Presidents Obama and Trump. Both were criticized by some members of Congress for trying to create policy without input from the legislature. Our next guest says that while executive orders are a powerful tool, they have limits that can act as their own kind of check on a president's vision. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about what a president can and can't do through different kinds of executive action? Does it bother you when a president tries to implement policy through executive orders? Or are you glad that it's an option, especially when Congress can't seem to compromise on a particular issue? And what do you think of what we've seen from President Biden with executive actions so far? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. Andrew Rudlevich is a professor of government and the chair of the Department of Government and Legal Studies at Bowdoin College. He's the author of several books, including the upcoming By Executive Order, Bureaucratic Management and the Limits of Presidential Power. Andy, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hey, it's great to be with you.
I use the phrase executive order a lot. That's just part of the toolkit here, right? Can you tell us about the range of different executive options that a president can use without having to go to Congress?
Sure. Well, over time, as Congress, you mentioned this already, has gotten more gridlocked, presidents have turned to a whole toolbox of executive actions, we might call them. That includes executive orders. It includes proclamations, formal memoranda to different agency and department heads. Could even include guidance documents that tell different agencies how they're supposed to interpret different regulations. And we might include those regulations themselves, right? When Congress passes a law, it usually gives a lot of discretion to the executive branch and how to implement it. And again, a president who wants to shape that has some tools for doing so.
We've seen high-profile executive actions of various sorts from President Obama, President Trump, now President Biden. Are they getting more common over the years, or are high-profile ones getting used more often, or is it just that we're noticing them more?
Well, I think we're certainly noticing them more, partly because that's where the action is, right? When Congress is unable to act, presidents have frequently sort of said, well, you know, as President Obama put it, I've got a pen and a phone. You know, we can't wait for Congress to act. President Trump said similar things. President Bush used to talk about how he could do things on his own if Congress was gridlocked. So we are certainly seeing that as a pretty prominent part of the president's program, especially in periods where Congress isn't acting. You know, in terms of pure numbers, they're probably not up dramatically. If you look back to the 1940s and at the list of executive orders that Franklin Roosevelt issued, for example, you know, he was issuing 300 or 400 orders a year, but many of them were very small bore. I mean, it used to be that to exempt somebody from mandatory retirement age, for example, in the entire federal government, the president had to issue an executive order. So those are no longer required in those kinds of cases. The executive orders we do see tend to be more substantively significant, and that's another reason we pay more attention to them.
We're talking about the executive powers of the president and its limits with Andrew Rudlevich. He's with Bowdoin College, and he's the author of the book, By Executive Order, Bureaucratic Management and the Limits of Presidential Power. Well, there's a big spoiler in your subtitle, Andy. There are limits. What are some of the boundaries that, you know, even if a president wanted to do more, they're kind of restrained here?
Well, there are two or three big ones. The biggest probably is that you can only act if you have previously been authorized to act by the Constitution directly or by statute in the past. So really, executive orders are exercising delegated power that Congress has already given the president. Now, the good news for presidents, I suppose, is that Congress has authorized quite a lot over the years. But nonetheless, presidents do have to be cognizant of how much discretion they have under the law. Another possible limit is procedural. Right, you actually have to justify what you're doing in a way that will allow, for example, a court to uphold your discretion under the law, especially with regulations. You know, if you don't follow the procedures laid out in law, then you may wind up in trouble. So, for example, you know, President Trump had tried to rescind DACA, the President Obama's, initiative to allow the Dreamers, so-called, to stay in the United States. The court just this year refused to allow that to be rescinded because President Trump had not followed the proper procedure in justifying his action. So that's yet another limit. A third might be that the executive branch itself has a lot to say about how executive orders are crafted. They're unilateral in the sense that the president issues them, but very rarely, you know, do they come straight from the president's brain. The wider bureaucracy has a role both in formulating them and then, of course, in implementing them.
And what one president giveth, another can taketh away. How much do we see executive orders ping-ponging back and forth, say, between Democratic and Republican administrations?
Yeah, well, quite a lot. And we've seen that already in the first not quite a week of the Biden administration. You know, in a number of his executive orders are, the revocation of Trump executive orders. And, you know, that's a quick way to send a message to your base. President Trump, of course, did the same thing with President Obama's orders. And President Obama, you know, took the opportunity in his first week to rescind a number of George Bush's orders. So there are, you know, some of these kind of travel throughout time. A Democrat comes in and automatically puts in a certain policy that's then reversed by a Republican. But many of them are, you know, aimed at sending a signal to your own base that, you know, you're different. You've been elected and you're going to change the way the policies are moving forward. You know, even if it's not going to happen very quickly, or even if it is more symbolic than substantive, right? To really make a substantive change to the Affordable Care Act, President Trump needed to try to repeal and replace it, which of course never happened. But he was able to send messages to his constituents that he was trying to do this by issuing various orders, trying to limit its reach.
As you mentioned, there have been some substantive executive actions in recent administrations. How much of that is coming from the difficulties in a president getting major legislation passed on hot button issues like, say, immigration along with Congress?
Yeah, I think quite a lot of it, to be honest. If you think about the growth of the federal government over, I don't know, almost 90 years now since the New Deal in the 1930s, you know, this growth of the administrative state, what critics often call the deep state, you know, that has built up a lot of administrative authority in the executive branch that a president can try to use to his advantage, right, in implementing his policy preferences. And then you also have the fact that Congress, of course, is subject to the partisan polarization that we see all around us. We've had divided government quite frequently. Hard to get things done. So you have all these old laws sitting around. And if you can't pass a new law, then maybe what you want to do as president is to come up with a new meaning for an old law. So you see kind of aggressive interpretations of what those laws mean, whether it's immigration law, environmental law, healthcare, education, right? So presidents are, have a big legal team on their side. And what they're doing in part is looking for ways to act without having to go back to Congress, just because it's so hard to get Congress to move proactively these days.
In some ways, this doesn't seem like the optimal way to be doing things, right? I mean, this is kind of, I don't want to say broken, but a bit of a dysfunctional system, if what you just laid out is turning into the normal practice. Am I wrong?
No, it makes a lot more sense, frankly, for Congress to revisit some of these issues, right? We haven't had the Clean Air Act, for example, was revised significantly in 1990, but that's, 30 years ago now. And, you know, if Congress wants to have a say about how, you know, environmental policy is carried out in this country, then it needs to revisit the ground rules that it passed 30 years ago, and in some cases, 50 years ago. You have, immigration legislation. When it came to the Supreme Court a couple of years ago, the travel ban case, Supreme Court looked at the Immigration and Nationality Act and said that it, quote, exuded deference, unquote, to the president. So President Trump said, hey, that's great. I can do more or less what I want in the field of immigration. And, but that's not really how the system is set up. Congress is Article 1 of the Constitution for a reason and really ought to be directing policy. That's a cleaner system. And it also, by the way, means that we're not relying on the courts to serve as the final arbitrators of what presidents can and can't do. You know, that's not necessarily a court function to serve as a policy creator, and yet they are called into that role very frequently by, you know, the controversial nature of efforts by presidents to assert executive action.
We're picking up our talk with Andy Rulevich, Chair of Government and Legal Studies at Bowdoin College, looking at what presidents can and can't do with executive orders and other actions. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts about executive action, how much authority presidents do and don't have, whether you want to see President Biden be more or less aggressive with using them, and of course, your questions about how this all works. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Andy, as we mentioned, President Biden has a lot going on with his various executive actions. What stands out to you as maybe the most significant content-wise, policy-wise?
Well, again, so he has a bunch of actions that are trying to roll back different Trump-era actions and sort of return to the, you know, I guess it would be the Obama status quo. You know, he's really focused on two or three main themes that he talked about in the campaign. Certainly COVID is one of them, right? Pandemic relief, that's been an important part. Now, the president, and this is a good example of, you know, the limits of executive action. You know, President Biden's White House has talked about a mask mandate. But, you know, and that, of course, is controversial, depending where you are in the country or in a given state. But, you know, the president does not have the power to impose a national mask mandate. That is limited if you look at his order to interstate commerce and travel, right? And, of course, to federal property. So, you know, sometimes the rhetoric runs a little ahead of the substance in these matters. But, you know, he's created a new testing board. He's trying to revamp the way that vaccines are produced and distributed. And so that could wind up being pretty important. A lot of what executive action often does is to reorganize the executive branch and to, we hope, make it more efficient. We'll see what happens there. He'd had an executive order relatedly telling OSHA, right, the Worker Health and Safety Office, to be a little more stringent in how it protected workers against infection from the pandemic. So, you know, that's one big area. We've seen, you know, others dealing with economic recovery. His very first executive order had to do with racial equity and ordering departments and agencies to try to do a better job on that front. So, you know, he's sort of making a down payment, at least on some of his campaign promises in those areas, you know, in conjunction, of course, with some very big legislative proposals that he hopes will get some attention.
Let's bring on a caller now. Gene is with us in Platteville. Gene, hi.
Hi, can you hear me okay?
Yep, go for it, Gene.
Okay, thank you. So I just made a couple, about 3 points. Okay, so going back in history just a little bit with Bush, he kind of was more of an agreement. I don't know if it had to do with his dad or not, but son Bush wanted to go to war. So he just kind of went toward that way, making that executive order. And then we had, and of course, President Trump, his more issue was more to actually be on the side of the billionaires and the corporations.
I'm going to jump in, Gene, because we just have a couple minutes left. Don't have time for all 3 points. I want to start there, though. She refers to George W. Bush and going to war. That was done with an authorization of use of force from Congress. That's been left with a lot of latitude since then, Andy. Can you talk about that part of a president's powers?
Yeah, well, the war powers would certainly be a whole nother conversation, because that's another area where Congress has really deferred a lot of power to the president. But in President Bush's case, right, of course, after the September 11th attacks, Congress did pass an authorization for the use of military force, which was very broad, delegated a lot of power to President Bush. And then the invasion of Iraq had a separate authorization in late 2002. So, you know, we can disagree with the way those were used, but they were authorized by Congress. One interesting thing, though, about both of them, they're still in effect, right? Many years after they were passed. And so, you know, the 2001 authorization, for example, has been used in using American force against ISIS. It's been used in Africa, right, in a bunch of places around the world that really have a very tenuous connection to September 11th. So, you know, this is yet another area, I think, where Congress should really be looking at taking back the war power, which, after all, is delegated to Congress in the Constitution.
Thanks for that call, Gene. We'll go to Jeff now in Superior. Jeff, hi.
Hi. During the campaign, Biden talked about codifying the Roe v. Wade law that Supreme Court decided years ago on the issue of abortion. I'm curious, with executive action, can Biden order a state to provide abortion services? Because I believe Missouri no longer has abortion clinics within their border. Or can the president order a state to no longer provide abortion services on that issue?
Jeff, thanks for the call. Andy?
Yeah, it's a very good question. And there's some interesting questions about federalism when it comes to presidential action, right? What powers does the national government have versus the states? Mostly what the federal government can do is either bribe or blackmail states to do something that it wants them to. And so in this case, you know, we saw it with President Trump seeking to withhold grant money, for example, from states, from cities that he thought were, you know, not, you know, handling, you know, the protests against racial justice over the summer very well, or so-called sanctuary cities, right? So basically what you have is the ability of the federal government to manipulate how funding gets to the states. And there are some possibilities, right, where you could give incentives to states to provide more abortion services, for example, or fewer, where you could stop reimbursing different kinds of health providers, for example. But you do get into questions of how those laws are written, what the regulations require. And states have been pretty successful in fighting those kinds of restrictions in court.
Thanks for the call, Jeff, at 800-642-1234. Talking to Andrew Rudilevich from Bowdoin College about executive order and other presidential authority and the limits it has. Let's go to another caller now. Sarah is with us in Zion, Illinois. Sarah, hello.
Trying to get to the bottom of this thing that's going on with Mitch McConnell and Chuck Schumer right now, where Mitch McConnell is refusing to, well, they're not coming to an agreement about what the rules should be. And are they able to, I mean, could that just go on for like the next 2 years? And I mean, is Biden going to have to just only use executive orders until they make an agreement?
Sarah, thanks for the call. Sarah pointing, Andy, toward dysfunction in Congress in real time, I guess, and whether that's going to motivate President Biden now to do more and more executive actions.
Yeah, it's a good question. Obviously, it does show the difficulty even in organizing the Senate, especially when you have legislative margins so close in the Senate and, you know, even in the House. You do you know, this is something that McConnell and Schumer will settle because it's in both of their interests to do that and to get a power sharing agreement in place. But, you know, to the degree that it's holding up, you know, the Biden legislative program, you know, or his nominees for that matter. And of course, let's not forget there's an impeachment trial coming down the pike. You know, all of this, you know, competes for very scarce floor time, and the incentives will be for Biden to, you know, again, take a unilateral executive action route rather than wait for Congress to get its act together.
Thanks for that call. Andy, do you see a scenario in, I don't know, the next decade or two where we could see smoother functioning between a president and Congress to where the temptation to use and maybe push the envelope on executive authority is reduced?
Well, remember, executive action doesn't always have to be in a way that's hostile to Congress. It can also be used to implement congressional action. So, you know, often when you do have unified government and, you know, Congress passes a law that the president has worked towards, you know, that then needs to be implemented. And so you'll see a whole flurry of executive action in that way. So I don't think you'll necessarily see less action, even if, you know, some kind of miraculous harmony settles upon Washington, D.C. But, you know, it would be used differently in that context, right, to implement existing law rather than to sort of invent new law, you know, many years after the fact. Is that likely? You know, I think the margins are going to remain slim. And we also have an issue where there's a certain partisan loyalty in Congress that makes it difficult to enforce even Congress's prerogatives against executive abuse, right? Most, Democrats and Republicans have tended to like executive action if it's done by a president of their own party. And then every 4 or 8 years, they switch hats and say, no, it's tyranny. And then the other side decides that, no, it's strong leadership. So given those incentives, which, by the way, really start, at the voter level, right? They start with the incentives that they're being given by their own constituents. I don't think we're going to see very dramatic change in the short term.
Andy, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Andrew Rudalevich is a professor and the chair of the Department of Government and Legal Studies at Bowdoin College. He's the author of the upcoming book, By Executive Order, Bureaucratic Management and the Limits of Presidential Power. And that's exactly what we've been talking about, what presidents can and can't do with different, or can't do with different kinds of executive authority with this change in administration.